Welcome to Crime Suit Podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Carter.
And I'm Hannah.
And this week we'll be discussing the disappearance of a four-year-old girl from Helena, Montana in 1983. This is the story of Nylene K. Marshall. Our story begins with the Marshall family. At this time, in June 1983, Nancy Faye Marshall, born Nancy Faye Chilson, had three kids, Nathan, age 6, Nylene, 4, and Noreen, age 2. Her two oldest children were actually from a previous marriage. She got divorced, remarried in 1979, and had two-year-old Noreen in 1981. Her new husband was a man named Kim Marshall, who at the time was taking vocational classes and was really into ham radios. And Nancy was working as a waitress nearby to afford Kim's classes. The family of five lived in Alhambra, Montana, which is a very rural area originally developed as a resort town and relied on the heavy traffic of miners, but has steadily declined as mining operations have decreased.
So these guys are in the middle of nowhere. Nancy and Kim actually met and married in California. That's where she's from. And so I actually have no idea why they're suddenly in this rural, isolated area.
I mean, if we're guessing, I'm guessing it was because if he's really into ham radios, he's probably into apocalyptic lore or conspiracy theories or just general feelings of preparedness. So they went out to middle of nowhere to study ham radio for really important reasons, I guess.
Okay, but what I mean, like, this is the middle of nowhere, I really think there's, like, it's not even a town, I don't think. Like, I was reading about it and there's just, like, two hotels and, like, one of them burned down.
Woof.
So I don't know the entire history of ham radios. I've never actually operated one. My dad has one. But something that might make this make more sense is that Kim and Nancy are actually Mormon. And the Mormon Church has pushed their members in the past to focus on emergency preparedness, including like making 72-hour kits and having food storage and all of that. And part of that also, I think, in the past and for some current people is also having an emergency radio and knowing how to operate a radio. So I don't know if that's where Kim developed this interest, if it was through his church, but that's kind of my biggest theory is how he got interested in this.
Kim was also a member of the Capital City Radio Club, which is what leads us to four-year-old Nylene's unfortunate disappearance. On Saturday, June 25th, 1983, the Marshall family was picnicking at a campground in the Helena National Forest with a group of other ham radio operators from the Capital City Radio Club, when about 4 o'clock p.m., Nylene was nowhere to be seen.
Do you find it a little bit sadly ironic that all of these people are gathered because they are emergency preparedness people and then an emergency strikes? And they fail?
It doesn't surprise me at all, because they're never prepared because they think that they're always prepared. At least in my experience with people like this, so.
An actual tragedy strikes, and they're like, oh shit.
The irony was not lost. 4-year-old Nylene had been roaming around the campground with a pack of other little kids, exploring an old cabin, catching frogs, and she was last seen sat down next to Maupin Creek, looking at the various beaver dams. Nylene had apparently gotten separated from the other little kids because it soon became evident that she wasn't in the campground anymore. She was barefoot that day, so family and searchers felt confident that she couldn't have wandered very far. The Lewis and Clark County Search and Rescue immediately began their preliminary search for Nylene that evening, hoping that she had just gotten lost nearby, but she didn't seem to be anywhere in the immediate area. The next day, about 200 volunteers showed up to help look for the little girl. While they were able to cover a large area, search leader Ralph DiCunzo did say later how difficult it was managing that many volunteers, and that it was the biggest search he had ever overseen. Most of the volunteers were just members from the Marshall's church, and one group of them actually got lost in the forest, and they had to spend the night in the woods.
But that also is like a testament to like how thick the vegetation is. That these grown-ass adults, they themselves get lost. So imagine what it was like for a four-year-old. If she accidentally wandered into the woods, what are her chances of being able to find her way back?
I actually sympathize with the leader of the search party, I guess, because like they have no cell phones. They're covering a huge area of super thick forest. And like, how do you even keep track of that many people? That's a ton of people. So
it's literally, that's like my worst nightmare.
Yeah. Especially because it's all in the fucking woods. Like, no.
You know what? There's like a 0% chance that this is going to happen to me, that I'm going to end up getting lost in the woods, because I just don't go in the woods in the first place. Done. It's like that old health class pep talk that's like, the only 100% effective way of preventing pregnancy is to just not have sex. And I'm like, I'm going to apply that logic to a lot of things. I can't get lost in the woods if I just don't go in the woods.
That's airtight logic. A local man named Larry Clifford brought his trained search dog, Duke, to help look for Nylene. Duke was an incredibly well-trained search dog and had previously successfully located almost 40 missing people during his lifetime. That's a lot. He was given a whiff of Nylene's scent and appeared to be hot on her trail, but immediately lost her scent just as quickly as he'd found it. Four more search dogs were ferried via helicopter to search the area, but also had no luck. The search for Nylene lasted 10 long days, from dawn till dusk, with no success. The creeks and ponds were thoroughly searched, helicopters flew over the area fitted with heat-seeking radar, but even hundreds of volunteers later, they didn't find a single trace of Nylene. It was as if she had never even been there.
Do you know much about sniffer dogs?
Not a ton, but that is super, super weird to me, that sniffer dogs, like a search dog, wouldn't be able to find her scent, which immediately makes me think that she drowned and her body was carried upstream somewhere, or somebody really did abduct her. Somebody picked her up and took her somewhere. Those are the only possible reasons why five dogs couldn't catch her scent.
So I don't really, I don't understand. I understand the basics of sniffer dogs, that like they catch like a chemical trail, right? So you give them a piece of the child's clothing. And I feel like this dog, if he's really successful and as well trained as his owner claims him to be, that he's found like 37 missing people or something, right, in his lifetime.
That's crazy.
But if it's just a four-year-old girl, she's barefoot, and let's say that she just wandered off into the woods, there's no reason why that dog shouldn't be able to track her scent and find her. Right?
Exactly.
Because if it was just a simple case of she walked even up to a mile, that dog should still be able to follow her. So this tells me that something interrupted her scent. So either she got into a car, she fell into some water, or something ended her trail and the dog couldn't follow it, right?
Yeah, especially since the dog was there so quickly. They can use sniffer dogs, I think, up to like a couple weeks after somebody goes missing, or even more. The fact that this was almost immediately after she went missing and the dog couldn't find her scent, that's a red flag to me. That's weird.
Also, I mean, one excuse that they gave about, because that dog was there, I think, that night, the very same day that she disappeared on Saturday. The other four dogs, adorably, they ferried in on a helicopter. That image in my mind is so cute that I'm like, hey, the doggy helicopter's here. I'd be like, I want to see. So they brought in these four more dogs who, such good boys, they're like, I'm ready to do my job. Apparently there was rain on Sunday, the next day in the afternoon, and they think that the rain could have affected the dog's ability to track her. But the fact that Duke was there immediately and he lost her scent makes me think that something weird happened.
Yeah, very weird.
Like, from a very surface level observation of this case, it seems like the most likely scenario is that you have a little girl, she's only four, she's playing next to a creek, and then she's never seen again. It seems like the most likely answer is that she fell in the water.
Yeah, that's exactly where my mind first went, honestly.
I think that's probably where everyone's mind would be going, because they're like, we last saw her over by the beaver dams. Everyone's probably like, oh, she probably fell in the water.
Yep, she's only four. Like, that is where my mind immediately goes. But especially as we get into this case a little bit further, I think my mind is changed from that. I think she was abducted. And something that we talk about a little bit later is that it feels like the police and the family reiterated over and over again, we were surrounded by a bunch of family and friends. It's so unlikely that she was abducted by anyone we know, which I hate that idea. Because most children who are abducted or abused are done so by people they know and trust.
A majority, yeah. Like, stranger abductions are a lot more rare. Majority of them are someone close to the family.
We have no idea if they looked into anybody who was there or not, but that does bug me a little bit that we don't know that or whether or not they even did.
So I read through all of the old newspaper articles that were printed at the time of the search. The search lasted 10 days, and I think it was like day 3 or 4 that the police overtly said that they ruled out a stranger abduction, but I don't actually think that statement was based on anything, except they said, well, this is an isolated area. All of the people here were really close friends and family, and the likelihood that a stranger wandered in and took her just doesn't make sense. And so they didn't even pursue the idea of foul play until after their 10-day search failed. So if she really was abducted by a stranger, that stranger had a 10-day lead where no one was even
considering the possibility of it being foul play, yeah. I really do think that she was abducted, and I can't help but wonder if it was somebody they knew, somebody that was close to them. The police concluded very early that foul play wasn't suspected in Nylene's disappearance because all the attendants at the picnic were close friends. The area was very isolated and nobody reported seeing any strangers at the campground that day. Nobody, that is, except 2 small children who described seeing Nylene approached by an unfamiliar man in a purple jogging suit by the creek. One child told detectives that she had seen an unknown male wearing a purple jogging suit near the creek. He had said something to her, but she ignored him and kept walking. A second child told a similar story about seeing a man in a purple jogging suit. The man had stepped out from a wooded area and tried to speak to her. She got frightened and ran away, but believed that Nylene had responded to the man. Another child backed this up. He heard Nylene say that she had to, in quotes, follow the shadow, but he wasn't sure what that meant. This was immediately before she disappeared.
So the police, I don't know if they immediately interviewed the children. I think this might have been later, because originally they're like, okay, obviously she wandered off. Let's get the dogs in here. Let's start a search. Let's check the woods, right? I don't know at what point they decided, like, maybe we should talk to the children who were with her right before she disappeared. But apparently there were 2 different children who independently from each other both said the same thing. Police said that these kids hadn't talked to each other before this about the man in the purple jogging suit. So they have 2 different children independently saying that they saw a man in a purple jogging suit step out from some trees, which, creepy. And apparently this man tries to talk to several of them. One of the girls is like, he tried to talk to me and I just ignored him because creepy man in a jogging suit in the woods. Yeah, just ignore him, you know? But Nylene was only 4, so I don't know if she had a really strong sense of stranger danger. She also had just spent the whole day with a big group of people who were all her parents' friends, so she may not have known that this man wasn't one of her parents' friends. And that he couldn't be trusted.
Yeah.
But one of the little boys said that he overheard the man talking to Nylene, and apparently this man suggested to Nylene that they play a little game together, and the man asked her, have you heard of the game Follow the Shadows? And Nylene said, no, how do you play it? And that's kind of all the little boy heard, because the rest of the kids, they ran ahead because they were all busy getting into trouble and doing a bunch of other stuff. What do you think that means? What do you think this guy was like trying to manipulate her to like follow him, follow his shadow?
Oh,
like,
yeah. 100%. If those other little kids were telling the truth, and I think that they were, I think that he was trying to isolate a little kid. He absolutely was. He approached 2 other children and they were not receptive to him. So Nylene was, apparently, and she was the one that he took. I think that the follow the shadow game is a way to just lead her far enough away from her group that she feels isolated, or maybe you can manipulate the situation, like, because she's isolated. So you can say, oh no, you're lost. Where is your family? Let's get you back to them. And then at that point, she can trust him a little bit and he can pick her up and say, let's go find your family. I'll go help you, right?
Based on even just this tiny little observation from these kids, it tells me that this man has done something similar before, because he was prepared. He knew how to talk to children. He already had this game, this made-up game, it sounds like, prepared and up his sleeve so that if he ever came into contact with a small child, he already knew exactly what to say and how to coerce them into getting close to him. So it's possible that this guy maybe already has a criminal record. He should be on somebody's radar, I would think, because I have a feeling he's done something like this before. Because he seems seasoned.
Maybe he's just gotten away with it over and over again. Nobody has ever suspected him. It does seem like he's seasoned, like he was good at playing the hot and cold game. He approached the little kids. He knew exactly who would be receptive and who wouldn't. Like, he would just take it in stride, which is what it sounds like from these children's accounts anyway.
Part of me doesn't think that he actually went to the forest that day to do this. Maybe it was just a crime of opportunity that he was just there to go hiking on a trail or something, and then he came across this group of kids and just took advantage of the situation.
Okay, but this makes me think, was the park they were at like a park you could rent out for events and stuff? Because I feel like there's lots of parks that are totally public parks, but people like rent out like the Boweries. They rent out the little Boweries to do like family reunions under, or baby showers, or like birthday parties under. So maybe it was something like that where he knew people would be there because people usually are.
But if you went there and you're like, and he went there with the intention of like hoping that there'd be loose children and that he could abduct one, which that makes sense. But why would he wear a purple jogging suit? Because that seems very distinct, and that's not something I would want to wear, because every kid remembered that. They're like, he was wearing a purple jogging suit.
Jogging suits, like windbreaker, like bright colors in the 80s, weren't like a crazy thing though.
Oh yeah, maybe they were all wearing purple jogging. Oh, yeah.
I'm like, that, like, in theory, like when you say it out loud, yeah, it does sound weird, but also considering the time period, it might have just been relatively normal.
It's like when we were doing Nancy Perry Baird's episode and you're like, I wouldn't drive a bright yellow car to kidnap someone, but apparently in 1975 everyone had a bright yellow car.
Exactly. So here we are.
Okay, so maybe he didn't stick out.
Yeah. Four months after Nylene's disappearance, the movie Adam, profiling the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh, was aired on national television. After the movie, 55 pictures of missing children were shown on the screen. Nylene's picture was one of them. No substantial tips were called in concerning her, but Child Find of America did print and distribute posters of Nylene in hopes that someone had seen her. She was also featured on grocery sacks, milk cartons, as well as billboards.
I do want to ask you, because just based on statistics alone and nothing else, whenever a child goes missing, the prime suspect should be the parents. Is there any thought in your mind that Nylene's parents, Nancy or Kim, could they be involved in any way? I learned something really depressing this week, and of course I have to share it with you. And I'm probably going to get hate for this, but I was reading recently, statistically, a child has the lowest risk of being sexually abused whenever they have both biological parents in the home. Weirdly enough, though, when a child is in foster care, i.e. like they don't have any of their biological parents, the risk of being sexually abused goes up tenfold. But children who are in a household with one biological parent and a live-in partner, like a stepfather or mom's boyfriend or whatever, their risk of being sexually abused goes up 20-fold.
Holy shit.
Yeah. But it's wild to me that a child would be less safe in a household with one biological parent and their partner than just straight up being in the foster care system with no biological parents.
Which is crazy when we know what happens in the foster care system. Like, mm-hmm. when you look into the foster care system and see how much of a cesspool it is for abuse and literal child trafficking in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it just straight up is. And then you know that a biological parent with their live-in partner, it makes it even more so exposed to that. That's insane.
Twice.
That's crazy.
Twice as bad. So it increases tenfold if they're in the foster care system, and it's 20-fold if they're one of their parent biological parents has a live-in partner. So now anytime I read stories and there's a step parent involved, I'm just like, I hope this is a really good step parent. I'm sure Kim was fine, but that's just where my mind goes to, is that I think I'm always going to be naturally suspicious anytime there's an adult in this child's life who isn't directly biologically related to them.
But Kim was Nylene's biological father.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't? I thought Nancy's first two children were not biologically his, and then they got married and had Nylene.
No, they had Noreen.
Oh. That's right, Noreen was younger. I thought Nylene was the youngest.
No, so Noreen... Oh my God, Nathan, you're right. Nathan was six. Yeah. Nathan was six, Nylene was four, and then Kim and Nancy got married, and then they had Noreen together. It's confusing because she has children named Nylene and Noreen.
Yeah, they sound very similar.
But yeah, no, so Nylene was not Kim's daughter.
Okay, that does factor in something weird then, because I for whatever reason, my brain decided to gloss over that, and that's why I became less suspicious, but now I'm like,
Yeah.
Then, in late 1985, over 2 years after Nylene's disappearance, a man contacted Child Find Inc., as well as NCMEC, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They were able to trace the phone calls he made to a phone booth in Madison, Wisconsin. However, after the calls had been traced, they stopped. It is reported that the last phone call was placed in May 1986, and the last letter postmarked soon after. It was stated that the letters contained information that hadn't been released to the public. However, there's never been any mention of what that information might have been all these years later. The author did possibly give a clue to his identity, mentioning that he had lost his parents and 9-year-old sister in a car crash years prior.
I just don't know what to do with this guy, because it seems so weird that you've got this rando in Wisconsin claiming that he's the one who abducted her.
Well, let's read them the letter and... Trigger warning, this is a little disturbing, so just so you know. Here's an excerpt from one of the mysterious man's letters. Quoting, I picked Kay up on the road in Elkhorn Park area between Helena and Boulder. She was crying and frightened, and as I held her, she was shaking, and I decided that I would keep her and love her. I took her home with me. I have a nice investment income, and I can work at home, so I care for her myself all the time. I teach her at home, and she likes to go with me when I travel. Her hair is short and curly now, and she has really grown. She is about 45 inches and around 50 pounds. She has all four of her permanent upper and two of her lower incisors at this time. She takes a bath and brushes her teeth every day. She eats well. Her favorite meal is pizza and cherry. She would gladly recount to you trips to San Francisco, New York, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Nashville, Chicago, Puerto Rico, and Canada. We were even in Britain for a month last year and she loved it. Nobody questions passports. She is a sweet little girl, and it is because of how much I have grown to love her that I realize how much her family must miss her. But she has adjusted and seems happy. She trusts me and isn't afraid. We play a lot, and she laughs when we clown around. She smiles and acts coy when I tease her. She giggles when we snuggle and hugs me sometimes for no apparent reason. I love her and I have her. I just can't let her go.
My general feeling about this letter is that it feels fictitious to me. It sounds like a pedophile who's narrating his like inner daydreams. And the reason I think that is because mostly the end part where he talks about how she laughs and we clown around, she smiles and acts coy when I tease her, she giggles when we snuggle and hugs me. That is one, super creepy. Two, it sounds like a pedophile who's just living out his fantasy. Like, he's just...
I 100% agree with you. So I do believe that the bulk of this letter is fictitious at its core. I believe that he really is stating his daydream right here. I guess I believe that the person who wrote this really did kidnap Nylene or maybe another little girl and has a fantasy of basically torturing this little girl's parents. I don't think most of the things that he wrote about are true. I don't think he's taken her anywhere. I don't think that they giggle and have a great life together. I honestly think that the little girl he's talking about is dead.
While I take the man writing it seriously as a suspect, I don't think that what he's writing is truthful. I don't think that he is raising this girl as his own and acting as a father figure. What I think is more likely when I compare it to other cases of pedophiles kidnapping children is that if this is the man that kidnapped her, she's probably already dead, but he's reliving or he's living a fantasy where he hadn't killed her. He did keep her and raised her as a daughter or as a plaything. Another part of the letter that I think is dumb is he specifically says he recounts how she's growing, says she's about 45 inches tall and about 50 pounds. She has all four of her permanent upper and two of her lower incisors at this time. Okay, I don't even know those things about my own children, like as a parent. If you ask me how many teeth my kids have, I have no idea. If you ask me how much they weigh, I could guess like a 10 pound range, but it sounds like this guy was trying to make himself sound smart or try and convince the police that he really did have her, and so he just looked up a growth chart and wrote down the average for her age and was like, what size is a 6-year-old and what developmental stages are they going through, and then he wrote it in the letter. Because I did look this up, if you Google like the average size of a 6-year-old girl, it's 45 inches tall and about 40 to 50 pounds.
So I also think that it could be some type of fantasy thing for him. Like when I worked in the special victims unit, I worked a lot of cases like this where there were adults preying on children. And a lot of pedophiles have very specific fantasies about children. Like, and it's specifically how much they weigh, how many teeth they have, what their toes look like what color hair they have. Like it's really creepy and specific, exactly down to like weird details like this. So I think it's also possible that this was part of it for him. Like he wasn't throwing that in there to prove anything. It was part of his weird fucked up fantasy.
Don't love that.
As terrible as that fucking is, and it is. Yeah.
So you and I both agree, we don't think that he actually has her and is raising
yes,
her.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
Are we not going to talk about the other fucked up thing he said in this letter?
We can. I don't want to talk about it, but you can. I think it's too gross.
So the other thing that he said in this letter that was specifically omitted when we read it was he talked about how he was feeding Kay, as he calls her, spoonfuls of his semen every morning and that she loved it. So this was clearly him reliving a fantasy, bragging, or trying to create some fantasy for himself. Like this was seriously fucked up, like on so many levels. But yeah, he included that in the letter originally. And I it's disgusting. I do think that it's relevant.
It's relevant because it helps you profile him as
yes,
an offender.
Exactly. Over the years, there have been various leads in Nylene's disappearance, but none have ever gone anywhere. There was a man named Richard James Wilson who actually turned himself into authorities in 1991, but police were never able to verify his story. Another report states that several years after Nylene's disappearance, her uncle saw a composite drawing of a couple wanted in another state for child abduction. He said that the faces in the sketch closely resembled a couple he remembers seeing on the scene the first day of the search for Nylene.
I mean, I don't really know a lot about Richard James Wilson. There's not a lot written about him, except that he lived in nearby Helen, and I guess he was mentally ill, and he actually confessed to a couple of different murders. And police took him seriously, and they brought him in for questioning, and they had him lead them to where he claimed to have buried Nylene's body in the forest. But essentially, the police couldn't verify anything that he said, and I guess he was ruled out because nothing could be confirmed. And eventually, Richard Wilson himself even was like, I made it all up.
But one of the most bizarre tips given to police was from a woman in a New Orleans hospital who said a 19-year-old woman came in to give birth, calling herself Helena. When she asked about her family's medical history, Helena stated that she didn't remember much of her childhood, and she thought her mother's name might be Nyleen. She was accompanied by a man, and before the hospital could get any more information, they both left abruptly.
There's way too many small details about this incident that point directly to Nyleen Marshall. One, the fact that this woman is calling herself Helena, which is the name of the national forest that Nyleen disappeared from. But this woman, Helena, who comes into this New Orleans hospital is Nyleen's exact age. So Nyleen would have been 19 years old at this time. She's with a man. And when asked about her medical history and asked, what's your mother's name? She said, I think my mother's name might be Nyleen. Out of all the names to choose, that one, I've never met someone named Nyleen. So it seems like a huge coincidence that she would say that. And also, New Orleans was one of the cities that creep in Wisconsin had on his list of places that he would travel with Nyleen.
This is really fucking weird. Like, all of it.
It would just be a very big coincidence. Especially, like, even if this girl theoretically isn't Nyleen, she's still someone that I would be very concerned about.
Yeah.
And be like, this girl came in, she's pregnant, she's with some random man, she doesn't remember her childhood, she doesn't know her mother's name, she claims to be from a foreign country but doesn't have an accent.
She came to give birth at the hospital and she left abruptly? Like, who leaves when they're about to have a freaking baby?
Even
like,
that's
that?
Not Nyleen. You need to track her down and make sure she's okay.
If your red flag-o-meter wasn't, like, fireworking at that point, then you have a broken red flag-o-meter. Do not take up investigation. According to police, they were able to track Helena down. She was living in Oklahoma City, and she was not Nyleen Marshall.
What the fuck?
How? How was she not?
How is she not Nyleen? But also, the other weird thing is they track her down to Oklahoma City. What? Why was she pregnant and about to give birth in New Orleans, but she lives in Oklahoma City, which is another one of the cities that the creep in Wisconsin had on his list?
Yep. How? How is this not?
This is the craziest story. Because, hear me out, today, like, if Nyleen is still alive, she'd be in her 40s. There's just no way that she's gone this long moving around in this world and there haven't been signs that she's Nyleen Marshall. Like, at some point, it would come up that she doesn't have a social security card, that she doesn't have a birth certificate, that she doesn't remember her childhood. You know what I mean? Like, there would be signs. People who knew her and were friends with her at some point would be like, yeah, my friend is a little bit weird. She, like, doesn't know anything about where she came from or who her parents are. And in this day and age, a lot of people have taken DNA tests. I just want to know how the police ruled her out. If it really was like, no, DNA doesn't match, okay, you're good.
Right?
Part of me just, I need to know more.
It's also possible that she refused anything more, like that she was uncooperative. But Nyleen's case has generated a fair amount of interest on the internet, obviously, but there have been no new leads in years. It's very possible that Nyleen was abducted by someone and is still alive today, perhaps unaware of her past. It's also possible that she lost her way in Helena National Forest and died of exposure. Although her case has been cold for decades, investigators haven't ruled out the possibility that someone knows what happened to her, and they hope to one day learn her fate. If you have any information regarding Nyleen's case, you should contact the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office at 406-225-4075.